Okay, thank you everyone for joining. Good afternoon. Hope everyone is healthy and well. For those who celebrated Shavuot, hope you enjoyed your holiday. Welcome to session 3 of Beit Midrash Zichron Dov's Business Ethics Series, Lunch Series, Lunch and Learn Series. My name is Rabbi Sammy Bergman. For those who have not met me before, I am the Sgan Rosh Midrash, Beit Midrash Zichron Dov, and a rabbinic assistant at Shaare Shemayim. I'm very happy to learn with you all today. Few brief notes before we get to the crux of today's session. I would love to give everyone credit for signing in and getting continued professional education. That's our pleasure. But in order for you to do that, if you could please leave your name in the chat so that we know that you are here. I will also try to take a screenshot in the middle of the session just to get some sort of identification for everyone, but if you can please do that, that would be very helpful to get you credit. Number two, I'd like to thank Shaare Shemayim and Bayit for helping to host today's event. And finally, all of the lunch and learns that the Beit Midrash provides are free of charge, and we're happy to do it. But if you so desire to contribute, contributions are welcome. You can reach out to me about that. I'm happy to help you out with that as well. But thank you all very much for joining. Right now, I'm going to post the link in the chat to the short sheet. Hopefully, you got the email. And let me also note that if you want to sign up for our email, please do so. And you get all our emails regarding all our Shiurim and Lunch and Learn sessions and business ethics sessions. The link to the source sheet is in the chat. I hope it's accessible. Let me know if you have trouble accessing it. Okay, let's begin. A lot to cover. The topic today is sinful and unscrupulous clients working for the devil. Hopefully, we all have wonderful client relationships. Hopefully, we work with our clients. They're honest and they simply want to do what is right and what is legal and what is ethical. And we simply have to go about helping them do that. However, sorry, George, is there an issue? Sorry, on mute. The source sheet didn't work? Sorry, I can't hear you, George. You're on mute.
No, I haven't. I just wanted to check in. I didn't know how to do it. I'm okay, fine.
Yeah, oh, no. Okay, no problem. Just put your name in the chat. No problem. Okay, so hopefully our clients are always truthful. I'm just going to put the source sheet in the chat again, and scrupulous, and it's all wonderful. However, there may indeed come a time in which they are not. And if that does happen, the question is, what is our responsibility? How do we interact or react when we understand that our clients are doing things that are not necessarily legal? Or furthermore, even if they are legal, what do we do from a halachic perspective if they require us to violate Jewish law? Meaning the question is, what is our responsibility in terms of not partaking in the sinful activity of others? So that is what I want to address today. And with that, I'm going to once again put the link in the source sheet for those who are signing in. And again, for all those who just came, please do sign in so that I can give you credit. But I'm going to now go to the source sheet and we will begin. So a few cases here to discuss. I think the first one hopefully will be the easiest to deal with and we'll all be on the same page with the first one. Case two and case three will be a bit more complicated. So here's case one. Samantha is a CPA who prepares tax returns for Josh, the owner of a real estate firm. After returning from vacation from Hawaii with his family, Josh asks Samantha to write off his travel costs as a business expense. When Samantha asks for a justification, Josh replies, "I called a client one morning to discuss a potential deal. And that's why I wrote off the whole entire vacation as a business expense." What are Samantha's responsibilities? Okay, so we have a client writing off their travel expenses as a business expense when indeed the purpose of the trip was for recreational purposes, and they simply spent a few minutes speaking with a client on a call. And they go to you, and you're their accountant, What do you need to do? Well, let's start off with this. Can you write off the expense? Certainly not. No one will allow you to.
No.
Now, what if I said, but you're not doing anything? I mean, you know, you're not the one that's stealing from the government. It's not your taxes. What would the obvious response to be to that?
You're advising.
You're advising them. Correct.
And the return gets signed off as you prepared it.
Correct. You sign off on the return and you prepared it. So this, I think, is a pretty obvious one, but I think it's still worth considering why it's a problem and what considerations and what responsibilities we have toward the public and toward the general accounting profession. If you look at in your source sheet, in source number one, I brought you a number of selections from the CPA Code of Ontario. And first, we have general rules and guidelines as to the way that CPAs are meant to act. And two of the rules require integrity and due care and objectivity. So let's take a look at source number one. This is CPA Ontario Code of Professional Conduct Rule. Rule 202. Integrity and due care. A member or firm shall perform professional services with integrity and due care. And number two, objectivity. A member or firm shall not allow his or her professional or business judgment to be compromised by bias, conflict of interest, or the undue influence of others. How does one define integrity and objectivity? One, a person who acts with honesty and truthfulness and whose actions, values, and principles are consistent is described as having integrity. Again, honesty and truthfulness. You have to be honest. Number two, objectivity is a state of mind which has regard to all considerations that are relevant but disregards those that are not. So even if Josh is an old pal of yours and you go back many years, you know each other for a long time, it's irrelevant. You can't lie for anyone and you can't falsely represent for anyone. You need to be objective. And it goes on to state, objectivity and integrity are two of the five fundamental principles of ethics, as stated in the preamble to the CPA code. These two principles are closely related and they are essential ethical elements in establishing the credibility of a member or firm. Objectivity is essential for any member or firm to exercise professional judgment. So number one, the problem with not being objective or truthful is you are not going to do a good job. You will not be fulfilling your responsibility as a certified public accountant if you are not objective and if you are not truthful. And beyond that, it is unfair to the public interest. As it notes here a few notes later in six, rule number six, clients, employers, and the public generally expect that a member or firm bring the qualities of objectivity, integrity, and due care to all professional services. It therefore becomes essential that members or firms will not compromise their professional judgment to the will of others. Right? If people are expecting you to be truthful and ethical, to not be truthful and ethical is just dishonest. It's not good for the public interest, those who are looking at the financial statements that you are preparing, and it's not fair to your clients. So this, I think, is pretty straightforward. And beyond the general guidelines of being objective and truthful and honest, we have specific rules in the CPA code saying you can't lie and you can't break the law. That's essentially source number two. And number three, CPA Code of Professional Conduct Rule 205, false or misleading documents and oral representations. I'm just going to focus on the first line because there's an important word there. A member, student, or firm shall not sign or associate with any letter, report, statement, representation, or financial statement which the member, student, or firm knows or should know is false or misleading. Not only can you not sign these statements, you can't even associate with them. And today's lecture will probe at this term association and how that is defined. So that's in terms of false representation. And in source number three, rule 213, a member or firm shall not associate with any activity that the member or firm knows or should know to be unlawful. You can't break the law, even if you are sort of being honest in doing so. So that should pretty much dispel the first case here. Obviously, you cannot go along with Josh's wishes to simply write off this travel as a travel expense. However, I want to point out that from the Jewish law, this isn't simply a question of association, which we'll get to. It's not simply that you are associating with legal or illegal or dishonest activity, but rather you yourself are doing something wrong in Jewish law when you falsely represent information. Anybody know why? What is the problem with falsely representing information? Yes, Miriam?
Could it be the principle of Ein Shaliach L'Varavera?
Ein Shaliach L'Varavera. Interesting question. So Miriam notes that in Jewish law, you cannot be someone's agent for an avera, for a sinful activity. We have a concept of agents in Jewish law, and the agency only works if it's for a legal activity. If it's illegal, then you are not a legitimate agent. I wouldn't argue, though, that might be an interesting question, but I think it's more fundamental than that. I mean, the notion of Ein Shaliach L'Varavera is that you requires agency. But I think it's even more basic. Meaning, even if
and aren't you give Rabbi, aren't you giving bad advice?
Bad advice. Okay. What's the problem with bad advice?
I mean, is that a stumbling block?
Okay, we'll get to the stumbling block question, but even more fundamental. Even more fundamental. What's the problem with false representation? So the rule is just in and of itself, and this is just the
link. Be a false witness.
Say again?
You're not supposed to be a false witness.
False witness. Okay, but you're not. Okay, so that's interesting. That usually applies to court. You can't falsely testify in court. Someone will rely on it. This is also a good point. Tammy notes, what if somebody relies on your false representation? You might be liable for that. But even don't rely on it necessarily. There's an isur, a prohibition in halacha against false representation. Gnevat dat. Take a look at source number 4. We'll just reference it briefly outside because I see we're already running short of time. But the Gemara is a fascinating law. As we know, there are certain types of meat that Jews are not allowed to eat if they are slaughtered incorrectly or if certain parts of the animal are not removed. But what if the following? What if I am a butcher and I sell my meat to both Jews and Gentiles? And Gentiles, even according to Jewish law, are perfectly allowed to eat non-kosher meat. The Gemara says that I am not allowed to give the impression that the meat I am selling is kosher, even to someone who doesn't have to keep kosher. I cannot imply that I went through the effort and trouble to make sure that the animal was slaughtered correctly if I did indeed not do so, because that's a false representation, because they will think, wow, you know, Rabbi Bergman was so nice and he went through the whole trouble to slaughter the meat appropriately according to Jewish law just for me. And indeed, that's not true. It's not only a question of, well, what if that person sells it to someone who does keep kosher? Even if beyond anything else, it is forbidden to falsely represent your product. And the Rambam here in source number 5 says this is just a question of basic honesty. We're meant to be honest and truthful people. Says the Rambam in source number 5. I'll read it in Hebrew. You could look at Simon Glazer's English below. Asher la'adam lahanig atzmo b'divrei chalakut u'pitoy. It is forbidden for a person to conduct themselves with flattery and allurement. Below ye echab peh v'echab elev. A person shouldn't speak one thing with their mouths and think one thing in their hearts. We shouldn't say something that we don't believe to be true. Ella tocho kibaro. One's inside should match their outside. Ba'inyan shebelev hu adavar shebepeh. And the things that I speak out with my mouth should be the same as those that I think in my brain and my heart. Va'asar lignov data briot va'piu data nachri. This doesn't matter whether it's a Gentile or a Jew. One, according to halacha, isn't allowed to falsely represent themselves to anyone. And the Rambam gives a few interesting examples. I'll note one of them, which I think is very interesting and relevant. The Rambam, if a person, for instance, is making some sort of feast, a wedding or something like that, and they have a friend or acquaintance that is very far away, and they know they're not coming to this wedding. No way, not a chance. What if a person says, so-and-so who lives in Australia is kind of wealthy, and maybe if I send them an invitation, they'll send a nice wedding gift. That is prohibited because you're giving the impression that you would like them to come to your wedding and you actually plan to invite them when you know there's no chance that they're actually going to come, right? And it's so even something as innocuous as simply sending someone a wedding invitation can be a false representation. I think it's very clear that signing any sort of tax return or anything like that, where you're falsely representing information to the government, would clearly be a violation of Genevat Daat. There's more to say about that, but I think that that will do for now. But let's move on to the more...
Can I interject a second?
Yes.
You know, that's a little problematic because every rabbi in town or rebbe sends an invitation to thousands of people for the wedding. You know what do you call it?
Right. Well,
you know, and the other issue is if you send, sometimes the party could get offended. So why didn't you send? You know, like, it's hard.
Right, for sure. No, those are both legitimate considerations. I mean, again, if you authentically would want them to come, and it's really a sincere representation of what you want, they just won't. I think that's different than a case where you know, I know they're not going to come, I have no interest in them coming. I'm simply sending them the invitation because, you know, I want to pretend that I like them, or to pretend that I'm showing them, you know, my expression of, you know, love and affection when it's not true. I think that's the point.
Now, is it just me or is your audio funny? Is anyone experiencing that?
Is that you right now?
It's very garbled.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
I don't know.
No. Now you're muted.
Any better now?
Say something else.
Hi, do you hear me?
That's better.
Okay.
Okay, so let's move on.
Thank you.
That's in regard to false representation. But there are more complicated cases, and some of them have already been mentioned, which aren't false, but they're still a bit complicated. So let's look at cases 2 and 3. And this is where we're getting to the crux of our discussion, although time is already of the essence. So let's take a look at case 2. Case 2 is a case where it's what you are being asked to do is totally legal, but it's halachically or problematic according to Jewish law. So case 2, David's accounting firm has done financial reporting for Wireless Commerce Inc. for many years. One year, David discovers that some of the products the company sells violate federal copyright laws. When David approaches the CEO, he replies, the sales are immaterial and that there are many accountants available if he feels uncomfortable continuing their business relationship. What are David's responsibilities? Okay, so actually that is clearly a problem, both according to, you know, Jewish and secular law. But we'll see as we go on that there might be a difference in terms of your responsibilities, in terms of what you're allowed and not allowed to do. And then case 3, Max, a non-observant Jew and small business owner, asks Sarah, an observant Jew and an independent auditor, to issue an audit opinion on his financial statements in order to procure a loan from a Jewish lender seeking 4% interest. If the loan is prohibited according to Jewish law, which it is Sarah permitted to issue the audit opinion? Does it matter if there are many other auditors available for the engagement? So here the question is, and I'm going to hold off on comments for now just to get into some of the material. Case 3 is, I'm being asked to release a statement which will lead to my client violating Jewish law while not violating secular law. And what are my responsibilities? Can I issue this opinion if I know they're telling me verbally that they plan on breaking halacha if I do so with the very statement that I issue? So this relates to the prohibition some of you mentioned before, stumbling blocks called Lifnei Iver Lo Titein Mikshal, and the beginning of this prohibition we see in source number 6. This is the verse from the Bible in Vayikra 19:14, where the Torah says, you shall not curse a deaf mute, Lo Tekel Al Chayresh, and in front of a blind person, Lifnei Iver Lo Titein Mikshal, you shall not place a stumbling block, You shall fear from your God, I am the Lord. What are the implications of putting a stumbling block in front of a blind person? What does that mean? There are two, believe it or not, even though you could have said it simply means taking a physical impediment and obstructing the path of someone who is literally blind, the sages understood this metaphorically as well. And again, just a brief reminder, for all those who are here and may have come late, please do sign in if you would like CPE credit. And I just once again put the link to the source sheet in the chat. So what does it mean not to put a stumbling block in front of a blind person? The first interpretation quoted in source 7 by Rashi refers to simply unwise advice. Advice that will disadvantage the person who is asking you. Meaning if someone asks you for advice, you cannot purposefully mislead them and take advantage of them. The summa, the blind person, is not someone who's literally blind, but blind to a certain matter, blind to certain information, and you can't use that to your disadvantage. The example Rashi gives is a business decision. They are deciding whether or not to sell their field. You tell them to sell their field and buy a donkey, knowing that the field is well more valuable than the donkey, and you buy it instead, right? So you're misleading them and giving them inappropriate advice. Simply unethical. It's not the right thing to do, to use your knowledge to their disadvantage. However, there is another interpretation of this prohibition, and the difference between these two is something we'll have to study as we go on. So if you look at source number 8, the Gemara in Bava Metzia has a fascinating, I believe, law described as follows. I'll read it in English. Rabbi Yehuda said in the name of Rav, anyone who has money and lends it without witnesses violates in front of a blind person, you shall not place a stumbling block. Meaning, if Miriam comes up to me and says, can I borrow money? $5, let's say. And I give her $5. The Talmud is saying, if I don't either have witnesses who are there to see me lend her money, or have another mechanism, either a contract or something like that, to determine that she indeed did lend me money, I am violating a prohibition of putting a stumbling block in front of Miriam. Why? Where is the stumbling block? Why is it a problem for me to lend money to someone else without witnesses? It's just, it's altruistic, isn't it? What could possibly be the problem of not requiring witnesses? Any thoughts? What might happen if I lend this person money without witnesses?
Well, I mean, there's confusion. Sorry, Miriam, go ahead.
Miriam may forget. Or if someone else may.
Deny.
Miriam, you think, you know, nobody saw it. His word against mine. And therefore, you start putting a stumbling block.
Exactly. Yeah. Meaning,
very good. I could get away with it.
Exactly. Meaning you are enticing them to deny the loan. You're giving them absolutely no impediment to lying. And you can't do that. Even if it's altruistic, you can't give them the incentive to simply commit a sin. Even if you intend to do it for nice reasons. That's what it would seem like from this Gemara. Parenthetically, if you're interested as to why it seems that we're not particularly strict about this specific case of lending people that witnesses, Michiel Michel Epstein in Aruch HaShulchan says, well, nowadays we all know each other, we're familiar, I know you, you know me, I'm assuming you're going to pay me back, it's an act of kindness. But the principle is that I can't perform an activity which will lead to somebody else committing a sin. So the question is going to be, let's stick with case number 3 for a second here. And I just want to cover some ground before we get to questions. Going back to our audit case, someone who wants to commit a prohibition by taking a loan with interest. Again, just to note, it is forbidden for a Jewish person to either lend another Jew or take a loan from another Jew with interest. Both the lender and borrower are committing the prohibition. A violation. And I'm not. I'm just working for these people. Can I sign this audit or perform this audit in order to allow them to procure a loan which violates halacha? That's what I'd like to explore. And to do so, let's take a look at source number 10. Source number 10 is going to be really important, so I'd like to read this slowly and carefully, and this hopefully will make the issues a bit more clear. The Gemara here in Avodah Zarah deals with the laws of idolatry, which were much more prevalent back in the times of the Talmud when they lived in the immediacy of actual idolaters. And the Mishnah there mentions a prohibition against conducting business with those who worship idolatry close to their holidays. Meaning a few days before an idolatrous holiday, one isn't allowed to conduct business with idolaters. The question the Gemara asks is why. And the Gemara gives two options. One option is not relevant for us for now. It's Mishum Harvacha, meaning, you know, if, say, your good old pal Xavier, the idolater, is your good pals with you, you do business with them before their holiday, they're going to thank their God, thank you so much, this was so wonderful that so-and-so did business with me, and causing them to thank their idolatrous gods is a problem, and therefore you have to refrain from doing so. I don't want to focus on that for now. The other potential problem is lifnei iver. It's this idea of placing a stumbling block before the blind. What is the problem? The Gemara is suggesting that if someone, say, sells an animal to an idolater before their holiday, the idolater may indeed sacrifice that animal to their god, and I have given them the ability to perform that sacrifice. What is the difference between these two cases? The Gemara says something very important, and now we'll read inside. The Gemara, if you look at the bold here in line number two, or I'll even read from the English, at the bottom of page two. What is the practical difference between the two opinions? The practical difference is in a situation where the Gentile already has an animal of his own. If you say that the reason for the prohibition is because he might profit, here too, the Jew causes him to profit. But if you say the reason for the prohibition is due to the prohibition, you shall not put a stumbling block before the blind, since the Gentile has his own animal, the Jew is not helping him sin. Namely, if the problem is causing another person to commit a sinful activity, if they could have already committed that act without my intervention, without my assistance, I don't have to worry about it. If they already own the animal that I'm selling to them, such that they could have offered it as an idolatrous sacrifice anyway, that is not a problem, the Gemara says, of lifnei iver lo titein mishol, of placing a stumbling block before the blind. This would be a huge dispensation. This would mean that in any situation, going back to our case, if I'm an auditor and I am asked to perform this audit to help my client procure the interest loan, the loan which will charge interest, as long as there's another person available who could do the exact same thing, it may not be a problem, right? However, the Gemara challenges this, and the challenge will end up being very important practically. Gemara continues. Is it really true? Is it true that if a person has their own animal, then they don't violate the prohibition of putting a stumbling block before the blind? But we know it's not true. Why? Because Rabbi Nassan, isn't it taught in the Braita that Rabbi Nassan said, from where is it derived that a person may not extend a cup of wine to a Nazarite who is prohibited from drinking wine, and that he may not extend a limb severed from a living animal to descendants of Noah, right? There's the two. There's a prohibition for a Nazarite, takes Nazarite vow against drinking wine, and all people are prohibited from eating a limb from a live animal that wasn't slaughtered. How do I know that's a problem? The verse states, and you shall not put a stumbling block before the blind. But here in both cases, if one does not give it to him, he can take it himself. And yet the one who provides it to him transgresses due to the prohibition, you shall not put a stumbling block before the blind. Essentially, the Gemara is saying, why is it prohibited for me to give a glass of wine to a Nazarite if indeed the Nazarite can take the wine by themselves? They could have gotten it without my assistance, and therefore it shouldn't be a problem. But the Braita, this statement suggests that it is indeed a problem, to which the Gemara concludes, Dekai betray ibridinaro. When is it a problem? In the limited circumstance in which I am on one side of the river, the person who I am giving the prohibited item to is on the other side of the river. such that they can only access the prohibited item with my intervention. However, if we were on the same side of the river, it would not be a problem. Okay? So it would seem at this point that when we talk about allowing someone or participating in the sinful activity of another, that it's only prohibited when it is my participation which allows for the possibility of sin. If that sin would have been accessible even without my intervention, then it does not constitute a violation of placing a stumbling block in front of the blind. Okay, that is the first principle we need to study. Any questions or thoughts before I move on?
Rabbi, just to clarify, so that's only when it's a Torah of error, but if it's a law of the land of error, then that doesn't apply, I presume.
You're saying illegal. So you're asking, what if I'm helping them violate secular law? Well, the problem is going to be that violating secular law is often also just generally for a vera. We're not supposed.
And no one's available to do that, really.
So
non-Jew's available to help them with respect to a Torah.
As we'll see, well, that's an interesting question. It's available to do it, but again, assuming that, well, look, legally. Well, I think the point that Paul is making is as follows, and this relates to case number two, right? Because the CPA Court of Ontario says you cannot associate with any unlawful or legal activity. It doesn't seem to me that if someone else could do it, it makes much of a difference in secular law. However, in Jewish law, if someone else can do it, we can't blame you, at least at first glance, for associating with this sinful activity or untruthful or dishonest activity. Mm-hmm. Yes, Jonathan.
I'm still having difficulty understanding where Lifnei Iver is coming in the third case.
Right.
You aren't a party to the loan. The loan is between A and B. The financial statements are just there as a tool, but in essence, you aren't the one giving the loan. You aren't the one receiving the loan.
But what about the fact that you're releasing a report, which will then enable the person to get that loan? So what you're asking is, how connected does your activity need to be for it to constitute participating in sinful activity? So these are some of the questions I'd like to raise.
Bearing in mind, you still have the opportunity of the legal fiction of a heteriska.
Legal fiction of?
Heteriska.
Heteriska, okay. Interesting.
We haven't got there yet.
Well, let that aside. We're going to assume for now that it's a problem. We're going to assume for now that it's a problem.
No, but where's the Lifnei Iver?
Okay. Let's define. You're making a good point. So let's attack some of the issues here. I'm going to have to briefly mention many of these outside, but I think many of the points you're making are all going to be relevant. So the first question to ask is, when we say that if it's available even without my participation, then it's okay. What does it mean available without my participation? This relates to a dispute between the Rama, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, a prominent halachic decisor, who comments on the code of Jewish law, and the Kitab Sofer, Avram Sofer in 19th century Hungary. Rabbi Moshe Isserles in source number 11 relates the following case. You'll just have to take the sort of reality as a given, obviously, which changed nowadays. The case at hand is the question of selling books that can be used for idolatry. And the assumption is as follows, okay? So I am trafficking, I sell these books. Now the question is, if we assume that the only people, I'm getting ahead of myself. The question is, what is the law if somebody could buy these books from another person? Right? What if I'm selling items used for idolatry, but there are other people who sell the same items used for idolatry, and the person buying from me could easily buy them from another source? Ramosha Islis in source number 11 says, as long as they could buy them elsewhere, according to at least one opinion, it's not a problem. So long as there's someone else selling the same item that is used for idolatry, it is not a prohibition of creating a stumbling block for me to sell the item. This would be a huge dispensation. So anytime it's accessible otherwise, right? And accessible otherwise simply means they could buy it elsewhere. The Kitab Sofer in source number 12 says, no. Hold on. I don't know if that's true. Because what was the Gemara's case when it said that you can access it otherwise? go back to the Gemara for a second. The Gemara mentioned two cases in which it would be prohibited. One is if they don't have one themselves, or if it's on two sides of the river. When we say you're outstretching your hand to give the somebody else something prohibited on another side of the river, is the assumption there's no way for them at all to possibly cross the river? Are we talking about the Pacific Ocean? Are you sending them a boat across the entire ocean? Probably not. Probably you're making it more easily accessible. You're making it easier for them to access the prohibited item. So the Ketav Sofer says it's not sufficient that they could buy it elsewhere. It needs to be that it's readily accessible in front of them, that you are not even allowing them or saving them any effort in accessing the sin. However, even if they could buy it at another store, if by going to your store it's easier, or because you're agreeable, because it's available right in front of them, that's still going to be a problem of creating a stumbling block. Namely, when we say giving access to a sin, do we mean literally creating the possibility of sin, or is simply allowing easier access to the sin a problem? And indeed, you look in source number 13, the Meiri, I think, or Menachem Meiri from 13th century Provence, provides a middle ground. Because the Meiri suggests as follows. If they could buy it elsewhere, then it's not going to be a problem of Lithna either. However, if you are giving it to them for free, even if they could buy it at another location, because you're making it that much easier for them to access, then that would indeed be a violation of placing a stumbling block in front of them. So one question to consider is, when we say making the sin accessible, does it need to be that you enable the sin, or merely giving access to it in an easier way constitutes this violation? I want to mention another interesting point, and then I want to analyze it for a second. If you look at source number 14, I know I'm going a little bit quickly, the Gemara in Avodah Zarah raises a point that Jonathan raised before. And the question is, how closely associated does your act need to be with the sin? The Gemara in source 14 is dealing with selling incense or frankincense to an idolater. And what the Gemara says is, you can sell it in bulk. Meaning if I have 300 packs of incense that I'm selling to someone who worships idolatry, that's not a problem. Because the assumption is they're not going to offer all of that as an offering. They're going to sell it. You don't buy 300 packs of something to then offer all of it at once. It's retail. The Gemara then asks, but wait a minute, even if it's retail, if I sell something prohibited to someone else, and then they sell it to a third person, the third person will violate the prohibition. Why don't I have to worry about that? To which the Gemara says, that's lithne, the lithne. That's placing a stumbling block before someone else who will then place a stumbling block. That's too disassociated from the sin to constitute lithne iver. It's not the proximate cause of the sin, and therefore it doesn't constitute violating lithne iver. Okay, so two steps removed. So you could argue that that's the same in the audit case, right? I, or in any tax return, financial advice, if I'm releasing some sort of report which will allow that someone else to use that report for a sinful activity, that's not necessarily a violation because it's two steps removed. It's too far removed from the sinful activity itself. However, this too raises certain complications. And this gets to the source, the case in source 15. Here's where we get to the Avodah Zarah books, the idolatrous material. So the case that the Shulchan Aruch, the Koro Jewish Law, deals with here in source 15 is these books that can be used to praise Avodah Zarah. However, the assumption is that it's back in those days, people didn't necessarily know how to read so easily. And it was only the priest that would be able to use these books to then serve idolatry. Okay, that's just going to be the assumption for this case. So the question is, if I'm selling it to a normal person, just the common folk, who will not know how to use this book for idolatry, is it permissible to sell it to that person? And is the prohibition only to sell it to the priest themselves? The Ramah suggests here in source number 15 that indeed some suggest it is only forbidden to sell these books to priests, but not to other idolaters. Because why? The person you're selling it to is not going to use it for a prohibition. It's only the person that they give it to who will use it for a prohibition. That's two steps removed. It's lifnei, the lifnei, and therefore it is not a problem of lifnei iver, lo titein mikshol. Okay? The question is this a good application of this rule? And this, the Bach says, no, not so fast. I don't know if you can apply it. And here's the issue. The Bach suggests, wait a minute, you're selling some sort of prayer book, which is used for idolatry. What do you think the person that you're selling it to is going to do with it? What, do you think they're just going to leave it in their house? Of course not. They're going to bring it to the priest. What else would they do with it? Either if they know how to use it themselves, they'll use it, or they'll give it to someone who does. They're not. It's clear why they want it. Namely, even in a case where your activity is not the proximate cause of the sin, if you know definitively that it will lead to the sin, it's still a problem. Okay, so take a look at source number 16. I'll read it in the English. This is from Rabbi Yoel Sirkis, the Bach, on this part of the Code of Jewish Law, on this comment of Rav Moshe Esalas. He writes as follows. It appears to me that one shouldn't rely on this dispensation to be lenient with the prohibition of idolatry. There is no proof at all from the Talmud statement that we are in particular about distant causation, for this was only stated regarding frankincense, in which it's possible he will sell it to another Gentile. But regarding illegitimate books, which are fit for prayer in a house of idolatry, and other books of their religion, where there is no doubt that the Gentile will use it or sell it to priests, it is as if the Jew sold it to the priest himself. If you know where it's going to, if you know the ultimate destination of this book, if you know that the act you're participating in will ultimately lead to a sin, even if it's a few steps removed, it is a problematic act. This is what the box says. So, what are your thoughts? Who do you think is right? And I wanted to think about two questions, and I think this will open up the conversation a bit. Two questions. Number one, should it be a problem if I am just enabling access and not creating the opportunity to sin? If I'm simply making it easier, if there's someone else available but they want me, should that still be a problem? That's question one. Question two, should it be a problem if I'm two steps removed, but I know the ultimate intention of the person getting it right for me? Yes, Miriam.
You use the expression, if you know. And we'll go back into your example. What if someone said, I need an audit report for you, and you go, fine. And the reason I need it, don't tell me the reason. An audit report is an audit report. I'm going to go through all the rigors of an audit report. I'd rather not know. Do you also have to go and find out the reason? Because an audit report is a very legitimate thing to do. Maybe it's better not to know, because if the whole crux of the matter is if you know, better you shouldn't know.
Fascinating question. We'll get to the point then. I think you're making two points. One is that an audit report is objectively a totally legitimate thing to do. It's not like you're selling someone an idolatrous, you know, book. It's simply something that you do as a result of your job. So that's in and of itself an important consideration. The other thing you're suggesting is maybe just don't ask. Don't ask, don't tell. So that relates to another consideration of what about if you're not sure? Lifnei iver on a doubt. So I want to address that here. It's certainly a good point. I could hear suggesting, though, I'm not sure. I don't know. I could hear suggesting, though, that if you have a reason to suspect, in the case of the audit, I don't know if you should suspect. Why should you? But otherwise, if you have a good reason to suspect that they're going to use what you're giving them for a prohibition, to just say, well, don't ask, don't tell, I'm not sure that's a legitimate approach, because we generally try to avoid helping people violate the Torah, right? It's something we have to not do, not simply to, you know, say, well, I don't know what they're going to do. But I think it's a great point. The question is, when we say you know, that's part of the question. That's fair. Yes, Jonathan.
We basically saying we are equating Avodah Zarah to basically somebody getting a loan with Ribis. I mean, up until now, we're talking about Avodah Zarah, which we know, which is the Yareg Uvale Yavor. A business transaction, while yes, it may transgress Jewish law because there's interest involved, and especially since the person who's doing the report is not a party to that loan and could potentially say, well, he may go and get an interest-free loan with that report, etc. So how are we jumping from something which is basically providing advice to a business loan to Avodah Zarah?
Great question. So I think your point is a good point in terms of what the Bach said, right? Or what Yoel Sirkis said, because he mentioned we can't be lenient about Avodah Zarah, right? We can't be lenient regarding idolatry. However, the Gemara itself is very clear that this prohibition against causing someone to sin clearly applies to all prohibitions. It applies to non-kosher food. This is really a very relevant question. It applies to non-kosher food. It applies to all sorts of things. It applies to giving someone a loan without witnesses such that they may not pay you back, right? So clearly it doesn't only apply to idolatry. Could we maybe be more strict regarding idolatry? Certainly, it's certainly a good point, but I definitely think we have to consider the definition of placing a stumbling block in all regard to all Esrim. Hey, Paul, if you don't mind, I'd like to just go a little further because we're sort of running low on time and hopefully we'll have some time for questions at the end. Okay, let me just suggest put the following thought forward, and I think it helps to sort of frame the issue. I would argue that these issues we discussed, namely how if it's a bit distant from the actual cause of the sin, but you know it will happen, one, or two, you're simply enabling access, may relate to what the nature of the prohibition of assisting with a sin is. And I would argue there are two fundamental ways to understand it. One way is to say it's simply like giving bad advice, meaning it's immoral to use your knowledge to purposefully dissuade someone from doing the right thing. It's also immoral, just generally not the right thing to do, to get someone else to sin. It's inappropriate. It's wrong. Namely, that what you're doing is just generally causing or bringing about sin. That's one way to understand it. There's a more ambitious way to suggest that it's not just that you are causing someone else to sin, but that in the event that you are directly involved with the sinful activity of someone else, you are considered complicit in their sin. That if you directly cause someone else to sin and they could not have accessed that sin otherwise, when they commit that sin, you are committing it along with them. So is it a question of facilitating, simply, you know, causing the sin of others? Or is it a question of you yourself participating in the sin of others? That you are the sinner. Why is this relevant? Let me throw out these two questions. So the first question was, what if they can just access it elsewhere, but it's easier? I would suggest that if we're simply saying that by causing someone or bringing about a sin through another person, you're doing something wrong, it's unethical, it's like bad advice. So then I would suggest that even if you simply make it easier for them to sin, that's also bad advice. They might not have bought it from someone else. You're making it easier for them. You shouldn't make it easier for other people to sin. However, if we suggest that it's not simply that you're making it easier for them to sin, but rather that through your association, you are participating in that sin, the standard may be higher. It might not be enough that you're allowing easier access to the sin, but rather it might be that you need to bring about the entire possibility of sin to be considered a participant in the sin itself. And furthermore, going to the other case, in a case where I am two steps removed from the actual sinful activity, however, I am certain that it will ultimately come about. So again, if it's simply giving or allowing the possibility for sin or encouraging sin, I'm encouraging someone to engage in sinful activity, which is not right. It's immoral. So then maybe even if it's two steps removed, if I know it's going to happen, I'm encouraging the third person to sin because I know that they're going to get it. However, if what we require is direct participation such that I am sinning myself, then even if it's I know what ultimately will happen down the road. Going back to my audit report, I'm doing an audit. I know he's telling me, I'm telling you, he's willing to lend me the money with interest so long as I hand in this report. Doesn't matter, because I am not directly involved in the actual sin. It's a step removed from the sin, regardless of the certainty. So with this, I'd like to explore sort of a few more issues, and hopefully we'll get to a clear understanding of some of these cases that we began with. Okay, so I'm going to have to apologize for lack of questions. Hopefully we'll be able to get to some of those at the end. There is a problem that arises in the Rishonim, which is the question of a rabbinic violation of placing a stumbling block when it is not a case where it's two sides of the river. Namely, is there a rabbinic prohibition if they could have accessed the sin otherwise? This ends up being a contradiction in the medieval commentators. If you look at source number 17, I'll just reference the case briefly outside. There's a Tosfot in Masechet Shabbat in 3a. The case there relates to the prohibition against transferring an object on Shabbat from the public to the private domain or vice versa. And the Mishnah in Shabbat suggests that if I don't do any transferring myself, I am in my house, I have a loaf of bread. There is a poor person who sticks their hand inside my house, takes the bread from my hand, and transfers it outside into the public domain. So I didn't do any transferring. They took it from my hand and brought it outside. The Gemara in such a case says the person standing inside has done nothing wrong at all. I didn't do anything. They took it from my hand. They brought it outside. They did both steps. I simply stood there. Tosfot in Shabbat is bothered. Why is he bothered? Because of our very topic. He says, regardless of whether or not you brought it outside, aren't you putting a stumbling block before the blind? You are facilitating their violation of carrying on Shabbat by standing there inside your house with the bread and allowing the poor person to take it from your hand and transfer it outside. Isn't that a violation of Lifnei Iver? And Tosfot says, you'll tell me, oh, well, since they could have accessed the bread otherwise, it was right in front of them, it should be okay. Because that's what we say in the Gemara, right? We say in the Gemara that as long as it's on one side of the river, it's not a violation of Lifnei Iver. Says Tosfot, that isn't going to cut it. It's still a problem. He says, take a look at the bold in source number 17. Nevertheless, there is a rabbinic prohibition because he is obligated to separate him from sinning. This reads to Miriam's point before. What Tosfot is saying here is that even if biblically, when the sin is accessible otherwise, there is no violation of placing a stumbling block, nevertheless, rabbinically, it's prohibited. Why? It's not enough to not place a stumbling block. You need to separate the person from sinning. You have an obligation to stop him from sinning. I can't simply stand there with the bread in my hand knowing that someone's going to take the bread out of it and violate. I have to say, no, stop. Don't do that. That is against the Torah. You are committing a sinful act. And therefore, it's at least a rabbinic prohibition, even if they're on the same side of the river. Now, this is going to create a lot of problems because now in all these cases, if they could find another accountant or another doctor or any of the cases that will relate to, maybe that's not sufficient. It's still rabbinically prohibited. However, there is another Tosfot. And this Tosfot, it's not in Shabbat, actually. It's in the Gemara of Orazar, we said before, that's a typo, which indeed suggests as follows. Take a look at source 18 in English. He says, according to this, it is forbidden to extend something forbidden to apostates. I can't, if someone doesn't keep the Torah, I can't give them something not kosher. Why? For it is known they will eat it, and they are the same as full-fledged Jews. You can't participate in the sin of a non-observant Jew. However, he says, this applies only in a situation in which they can only access the item because the observant Jew extends it to them. Says Tosfot, it's okay to give someone who's non-observant a non-kosher food so long as they could have gotten it otherwise. But that's a problem. Because Tosfot just said, even when they're on the same side of the river, it's still a rabbinic prohibition. Because even if I'm not facilitating the sin, I have an active obligation to stop them from sinning. And there are a number of medieval commentators, Rabbeinu Asher and others, who quote both of these rulings. So the question is how to deal with this contradiction. Okay, so let me briefly give you two solutions to the contradiction, and then we can get to some of the leniencies here and hopefully come to some conclusions. I'm sorry, I'm running a bit late here, but bear with me. Here we go. There's two ways to solve this contradiction. The first relates to the person at hand. This ends up being a huge dispensation. The Shach, or Shatei HaKohen, a prominent commentator on the Code of Jewish Law, suggests it depends on whether the person you're doing it with is committing the violation on purpose. Namely, so long as the sin would have been accessible otherwise, if the person that you are associating with is purposefully violating the law, they mean to do it, they know it's a sin and they're doing it anyway because they just don't keep the halacha, you don't have to stop them from doing it. The requirement to stop someone from sinning, says the Shach, only applies when they subscribe to the law. If they're sinning on purpose, you don't have a violation in a case in which it's on the same side of the river to prevent them from sinning. This would be a huge dispensation. This would mean that in any case in which the person that I am dealing with, my client, is purposefully violating the law, I would have the ability to help them out, provided they would have access to someone else who could do the same thing. That is one way to solve this contradiction. However, in the case in Shabbat, if the person who is going to the door is not aware that they are violating Shabbat, even if they could violate it otherwise, I have to stop them from violating the sin. Others do not like this dispensation because the general rule is that we don't help anyone sin, regardless of whether or not they're observant or non-observant. We have care for all people, and therefore many reject the Shach. However, the other dispensation here relates to the question of immediacy. Does my assistance take place at the time of the sin, or does it take place before the sin? Namely, in the case in which I stand there and enable someone to take the item out of my hand and carry it outside, I am participating in the very moment of their sinful activity, at the time of the prohibition. In such a case, even if they could have accessed the prohibition otherwise, it's still a problem. However, when I give someone food that I know is prohibited, so long as they could have gotten it otherwise, since when I give it to them, it's a step removed from the actual eating of the prohibited food, it is not constituted of era, as long as they could have accessed the food otherwise. Okay, so a lot of concepts here. Let me briefly review some of them, and then I will end with a number of leniencies, and we'll go back to our original questions. So we talked about this prohibition against associating oneself with sinful behavior. What I think we see is that the halacha has a unique perspective on this. In halacha, there is a distinction between when the sin would have been accessible otherwise, or it would have not been accessible otherwise, as opposed to secular law, where if you're associated with the activity in general, it seems like it's prohibited. In halacha, there is a dispensation for participating in an activity when you are not creating the access point to the sinful activity. However, there are a few questions we discussed. One was whether or not simply enabling easier access is a violation. Two, what if it's a step removed? Three, in the case where it is a step removed, what if I know the intention is to ultimately cause the sin? And then finally, what about when it is accessible? Is there still rabbinic prohibition? So now let me just end briefly with the case of the Tzitz Eliezer in Source 43. It's a bit of a loaded case, but I think you'll find it helpful in terms of some of our original cases. The Tzitz Eliezer is asked three different questions. Question one, if an anesthesiologist, look at Source 23, who needs to anesthetize a woman for an abortion when the abortion is not performed with a halachic permit, right? So abortion is a complicated topic, but assuming that the abortion being performed is against the halacha, can I put this the patient in under anesthesia knowing that it's due to a procedure that is against halacha? Question one. Question two, can you perform an ultrasound in a pregnant woman to look for a fetal malformation? If you know that it's possible or likely even that if it is found that there is a fetal defect, the patient and the doctor will choose to perform an abortion against halacha when it is against halacha. Again, that's a complicated discussion. It's number three, in a test to diagnose if a patient is brain dead. So we have a patient here whose heart is still beating, but they are unconscious. And the question is, can we perform a transplant on that patient? And the doctor is being asked to perform an examination to determine whether indeed there is brain death or not. But can one do so if they know that if the patient is indeed brain dead, a procedure will be performed, which again may be against halacha? And believe it or not, the Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, is lenient in all three cases for a number of reasons. Number one, he says if there's another physician available, then it's not the biblical prohibition of lifnei iver. Number two, in terms of the rabbinic prohibition, there are a number of reasons for leniency. First of all, the notion of providing an examination is inherently a perfectly permissible activity. When we talk about making someone stumble, we're specifically talking about doing something which is inherently going to lead to a sin. But performing an audit or performing some sort of financial report or an examination is inherently perfectly legal. So what they do in response to that activity ends up being not a problem. Another reason for dispensation is, according to the Shah, if the person is violating the prohibition on purpose, then you can be lenient so long as they could have accessed the sinful activity otherwise. And also, you don't know the ultimate result of the examination. If you're performing an examination and you don't know whether or not they're going to find that defect or find that the person is indeed brain dead. So in such a case, since you are not 100% sure, therefore he is lenient. So finally, and again, I'm a bit over time, just to briefly go back to our three cases. Case number one, we said it's for certainly a problem. You cannot falsely represent information for a quiet, for a client. Case two, what is my responsibility to David, or excuse me, to my client, if I know they're violating federal copyright laws, but they could easily find someone else to do so for them and sign on their report? So it would seem to me that legally, according to secular law, you certainly cannot associate with such a client. It's illegal and it's dishonest. However, maybe, assuming you're not going to violate anything explicitly, you're not going to write something on the report that's false, which is an interesting question, it could be halachically there's more room for leniency if they could find someone else to do the exact same thing. And number three, what about the case of providing the audit for someone who is non-observant and who is going to use the audit to perform a prohibition? I would argue that according to Tzitz Eliezer, there are many reasons to be lenient. Number one, because the audit is inherently not a problematic activity. Number two, because if the person is purposefully violating the prohibition, it's very possible that according to the Shach, then at least the rabbinic prohibition wouldn't apply. So therefore, so long as someone else is available to perform the audit, There should be a reason for leniency. So what I'll end with is simply to say that I think the perspective of both secular and Jewish law is that generally we can't simply say it's not my problem, they're the one doing the sin. That generally we should be worried not just for our own sinful activity, but for someone else's sinful activity, for participating in a sinful activity. And in general, we don't want sins being performed in the world. We want the world to be a place of merit, of honesty and truthfulness, and we should do what we can to avoid participating in sinful activity. However, in a situation of need, there may be reasons for leniency in a case where they could have accessed a sin otherwise. So a lot to say also about what you do to confront a client, Unfortunately, we're out of time, but thank you very much for participating. And again, please, if you haven't yet, please do sign in the chat. And I'm happy to stay for a few minutes for any questions. Thank you very much.
It's great. Very nice.
Does that mean you should be